and welcome to Revolutionary Woman. My name is Tess Silverman. Women around the world are constantly creating ways to make a difference in their communities, and today's guest is no exception. Erin Schnabel is a distinguished engineer at Red Hat and a Java champion with over 25 years of experience as a developer, technical leader, architect, and advocate. Erin prefers being up to her elbows in code. She learns and teaches through practical and occasionally ridiculous application, focusing on automation and developer experience. As chairperson of the Common House Foundation, she is building tools to automate all the things, wielding Java and TypeScript with equal enthusiasm. Hi, Erin. Welcome to Revolutionary Women. How are you this morning?
I'm fine. It's nice weather. It feels like it's almost August, but it feels like fall is coming. Fall's my favorite season. It's actually cold.
Oh, sunny. Really? Okay, yeah,
so
it is sunny.
Perfect, not cold. Cold is the wrong. It's 71 degrees Fahrenheit, which for August is cold.
Ah, like, you know, okay.
Your body is like, what is this? It's not scorching hot. And so that makes it cold.
I know. Yeah, I love fall weather too. That's my favorite season. So, well, welcome to Revolutionary Woman. Thank you for coming on. So I have a bunch of questions. So let's get started. So you grew up near Baltimore, Maryland. What was it like for you growing up in Maryland?
Baltimore is it's an interesting area. It doesn't have the best reputation now, thanks to TV. but, you know, it's average. Where we grew up was average suburbia. I think the unique parts about living in Maryland is that it can't make up its mind if it's north or south. So some of the, like, there's a little bit of an accent around Maryland that's not quite sure if it's north or south. The weather is really weird. You don't get a lot of snow. Most of the time the snow lasts, like, you know, a blink and then it's gone. Unless you get a blizzard, which has happened only a few times. When I was a senior in high school, we had, I think, 2 weeks off of school.
Oh, wow.
Because we got the Maryland special, which is, oh, hey, yo, it's going to, like, get real cold overnight, enough to, like, freeze the slush that is made over the day.
Oh,
so we had people ice skating out in parking lots and stuff. Like, you couldn't go anywhere. Walking, like, taking our dog out to the backyard was an adventure because everything was just ice.
Oh,
it was
gosh.
Ridiculous. My dog was like, you know, step, step, all four in different directions, step, step. So, but otherwise, given my age, right, I'm an average Gen X kid. So it was Baltimore in the 90s.
Okay. So, okay, one thing I thought was really cool. I read that you were always interested in computers. And there was this one story about you when your dad brought home a computer. Can you share that story with me?
Well, my dad brought home, he was a mechanical engineer, so he really know computers very much. But for whatever reason, the first computer that he brought home was an air quotes laptop. we would better know it as a luggable, technically a portable computer, but it had like the little flip-up screen that was maybe 4 inches tall. 2 5-and-a-quarter floppy drives, no RAM to speak of. The way we ran programs and stuff was like, gosh, you look back now, you're like, whoa.
Yeah.
16 whole colors? What is this? So I was playing around with that computer, and then a couple of years later, he brought home another one. And that was, I think, maybe 10, 11. I was putting the modem into that one, and I knew how all the disk drives work, and that was like Windows 3.1.
Oh my gosh.
And which was exciting. And then I went to format the drive to install something and I forgot the /sys, which bricked it.
Oh geez.
So it wouldn't boot. And I didn't know what I did. I'm 10, right? I'm 10.
Yep.
And I've broken the family's computer. And I was like, what? And so my dad had to like take me in the computer to the computer store and I don't really remember what the guy looked like because I mean, I was 10, right? Like the facial memory is like gone, but I just remember like that tolerant, patronizing, like poor kid, all you forgot with these four characters.
Oh
and like,
I felt
really stupid, but, yeah, I still have a MS-DOS book somewhere from
really? Oh my gosh.
Those days. I don't know.
But you were 10.
I was 10. I know, right? I was 10. And so, like, right now, my kids are, like, 11 and 15, right?
Oh,
so
wow. Uh-huh.
What scars me for life is, like, they come and they're like, oh, it just glitched. Like, why don't you know how that works?
Right.
Why aren't you interested in, like, taking the machine apart and understanding what's broken? Like, no. It's broken. I'm like, oh, my God.
Oh my gosh.
I'm dying inside.
That's so funny. Oh my gosh. And now you can, I mean, like, they were your age when you
yeah.
did this.
Yeah. And all I know is, like, iPads and uh-huh. things that are, like, totally sealed devices. So
yes.
You really can't see the guts, you know?
Right. Right.
When I was young, everything was improving incrementally and exponentially.
Mm-hmm.
So building mm-hmm. your own system was a thing you did every couple of years.
Oh, wow.
You had to go figure out what all the cards were
yeah.
and all that stuff. So they just have no idea.
Right, right. Because it's already been done. It's all in there. That yeah, that's so funny. And I love that you did that, because my husband actually did that for our daughter. That was the one thing that he actually did with her in terms of computers. He helped, like, he actually built, and they both built this computer together, which he was hoping would inspire her to go into computers, and it didn't. It was like, oh, okay. So she decided to go in the medical route instead. But at the time, she was young, I think maybe 11 or 12. And
yeah.
he was like, you know, I think this will be a fun thing for us to do, and blah, blah. And she was into it until it got done. And then she was like, okay, I'm done. I'm good with this. So, but I love that story, because even back then, you were really into creating something, like building something, right?
Yeah.
And so did that, inevitably it did, but did you think that you were going to be, like, more into building and more into, as opposed to, like, you know, basically having
it? I will tell you something strange.
Yeah.
This is something strange with me, maybe.
Okay.
Maybe other people will be like, yeah, I'm like this too. I did not have a vision of future Erin when I was 10.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I did not plan what I was going to do when I got big. Like, I still don't know what I'm going to do when I get big. It's fluid, amorphous. I'll keep doing interesting things and I'll get wherever I'm going to get. Like, I don't have a fixed, right? And I say that, like, one of my cousins had a very fixed, like, I'm going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
because she knew what she wanted to do, she staged all of her stuff to get to where, you know, she just had a very clear
mm-hmm.
line of sight.
Mm-hmm.
I had some things, like, that I know that I don't want to do.
Right.
I have my don'ts.
Okay.
Like, I don't have the patience to be an educator. Uh-huh. I don't have the interest at all in any way, shape, or form ever to be a people manager.
So
I have clear lists of don'ts.
Right, right.
But the do's are kind of a little broader than that.
Right. Okay, but I mean, even back then, you loved tinkering with things, right? Or building stuff. So
100%. There's something that I started to realize that I think is kind of strange. So my sister has a PhD in engineering education.
Okay.
This is related, I swear.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that she has studied is how women culturally are, like, guided away from technical fields at a very young age.
Yep.
Not necessarily even consciously, right?
Mm-hmm.
It just sort of
mm-hmm.
happens.
Right.
But what I have figured out as I have grown is that that's kind of bullshit, excuse my language,
mm-hmm.
but it's because I think that we categorize creation in a kind of narrow way. So here, I have an engineering brain. I love
mm-hmm.
building stuff. I love
mm-hmm.
taking stuff apart. I will tell you, any woman who does a lot of crafting and plays with a Cricut machine and assembles stuff,
mm-hmm.
that's engineering.
Yeah.
It's a different kind.
Right.
To a different end with a different
right.
purpose. But in
right.
terms of, like, solving problems and figuring out how to create and build a thing,
mm-hmm.
that counts.
Yeah.
In my book, right? Like,
yeah.
It's a creative problem-solving mindset.
Right.
And I just think we are like, well, if you're not doing bridges,
yeah, yeah,
it's not
yes.
engineering. And I don't
yeah.
like that anymore, because I think that's part of what makes certain careers good or bad, right? It
right.
adds a it implies a value that I don't think is useful.
Yes, you're right. And it's the label part of it. You know, the labeling is also, it kind of puts like a, I don't know, not a bad taste, but it's like, well, you're labeling something as opposed to just letting it be what it is, right?
So, well, and appreciating the mindset where it occurs.
Right, exactly. Right?
Like,
yeah.
How would I know? I can remember there was a friend of mine, and we were going to take a programming course. We were going to do Pascal, because that was the thing that we mm-hmm. did back then. Mm-hmm. And I remember her saying to me, like, I don't think I'm going to be any good at that. And I'm like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
She was great at math, very logical, if this, then that kind of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And she was stellar. You know, she was just worried about it because it had kind of a, you know, only nerdy people do that. And that mm-hmm. wasn't really her thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other side of that, still, like, to be a tech person in software, mm-hmm. there is a weird, like, oh, you have to be good at math. Do you know what I suck at? Math. Like, I could do logic stuff, right? I could do all the logic math. Do not ask me to do a differential equation. I don't even know. I don't remember. My husband, we met in college, and he's fantastic, and I love him. And he basically figured out I was not going to be able to do physics, and he would shove enough stuff in my brain that I would get through the exam, and it would all fall out again. Like,
oh,
I just,
gosh.
Like,
yeah.
You know, math.
Right.
The equations could be, like, do I know what big O notation means? Yes. I have a very intuitive feel, but do mm-hmm. not ask me to prove it with logarithms, because I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean I'm a worse technical person. Do
right.
you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, my ability to do that brute force math
mm-hmm.
has nothing to do with my ability to write good software that will evolve well over time.
And I think also it's also like a, it's been drilled into girls, right? That girls don't do math, or girls don't know how. I mean, it maybe not for everyone, but I even remember my daughter saying, "I'm not good at math." I'm like, "But you solve things, you know." So I think it doesn't have to always be. It's logic.
Well, you know what's weird?
It's a combination,
it's like,
maybe.
We'll go back to the early history of computing.
Mm.
There are women.
Yes.
Women count stitches. Women do knitting.
Yes.
Women do all of the, like, women can do math. We're
right.
really good at it, actually.
Right.
All of the people who did, like, early physics stuff, the computers, yep. right?
Mm-hmm.
Go watch Hidden Figures.
Mm-hmm.
The computer. All women.
Mm-hmm.
Our brains are great.
Right.
Well, except for mine. I can't do arithmetic at all. I'm not that. But that's part of why I am calling out, like, that labeling of what
mm-hmm.
an engineering mind is, because
yeah.
I think that's a recent social construct
mm-hmm.
that is, frankly, gatekeepy.
Yes. Then. Yes. And yeah, it's also, like, very limited. It's very limiting, you know, if you're labeling someone that way. It's like, well, okay. And then it becomes a subconscious kind of thing, you know. It's like, wait, okay, maybe I don't know how to do this, you know. But in reality, it's like you said, you think there's so many things that you use math for without even having to think that it's math, right? So
in my case, I guess I'm trying to distinguish math from logic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You usually, like, theoretically speaking, or the way we categorize subjects
mm-hmm.
When you're looking at a school curriculum,
right.
logic is technically under mathematics. It could
yeah.
also be under philosophy
mm-hmm.
too, right?
Right.
It's one of those that's sort of in that area.
Mm-hmm.
To be a really good software technologist, you should know logic,
mm-hmm.
you know, the if this then that and the
yes.
decision trees and all of that stuff. But that's different than, you know, raw computational stuff. And unless you're
right.
going to be a theoretical computer scientist,
right. Right.
There's a whole bunch of math you don't actually need to still be able to be really good at your job.
Yeah. I love that your story is really multi-layered, you know, because it started off with at 10 years old, you know, doing this. And then it's evolved over the years into being a software developer. And I mean, in between that, were you interested in anything else, or was it always like, well,
software happened while I was in college. I went to college to do actually controls engineering, That lasted a hot minute and was like, this is boring. No way. And that's actually because I did some internships with my dad. My dad was a mechanical engineer, right, by training, not necessarily, like, he came up through apprenticeship programs, right? Mm-hmm. So he's definitely doing mechanical engineering, but without the formal engineering degree, as you might say. Yeah. But working at his manufacturing plants, the way all of those assembly, you know, his the assembly line machinery and stuff works, it's all controls, mm-hmm. right? It's all control programs to make sure the presses and the blah 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 whatever,
right,
but they all operate at the same time. Okay. So in my head, I was like, yeah, that's cool. I can go program those. And then I'm like, this is so boring. And I switched over to computer engineering again because I use computers all the time. That's right. Like an area of interest for me. But even then, there were parts of that program that I ended up, I really didn't care about. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not going to chase this. I don't want to do circuit design. Mm-hmm. I don't want to design chips. Like, right. That's not where my mojo is. Mm-hmm. So going into a master's degree, then it was into software engineering and computer science. So it kind of grew. Okay. I have some foundational elements in terms mm-hmm. of computer engineering, but it was like, even then, chasing what made me happy. Mm-hmm. Or what held my interest.
Right. Okay. So you worked with IBM for 21 years and then currently at Red Hat for now almost 4 years. So
my entire career path has been staged around avoiding interviews. So when I was in college, coming out of college, right, you have the job there. I hate interviewing. I'm terrible. I'm so terrible at interviewing. And it happens.
Why do you say that?
Oh, because I have a hard time in that environment establishing good rapport. I happen to have a really good relationship with a woman who came to interview me came to the campus for IBM, but that was so long ago. Mm. And my career at IBM kind of grew. IBM's really big, so you get to move around a little bit. Mm-hmm. But it all sort of evolved very naturally, so it wasn't a lot of interviewing across.
Oh,
wasn't a lot of interviewing.
Right.
And then when I moved to Red Hat, it was a move after the acquisition. I didn't have to interview.
Okay. And so what is your role at Red Hat?
I report directly to Mark Little, who's the vice president of the middleware organization. My role there has been somewhat interesting. I've worked on Quarkus. I do a lot of technical advice. Cross organizational observation interaction. Like, I get to be glue bind, you know, binding glue stuff. I'm doing it. See, this is why I can't interview. I can't even tell you what I do right now. It's very much a glue role. Coming into Mark's organization, he already had people who you would say own things, mm-hmm. right? They own the delivery of this, or they own the progression of this project, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I am not the person who necessarily feels like I can own and drive things, mm-hmm. but I don't feel that that's all there is.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the only way to make an impact, right? Can you
help
people build a better thing? Can you help establish communication to make it more integrated into other areas? Like, it's a collaborative kind of role.
Mm-hmm.
Some heads up strategy focus. And then right now I'm working on Common House.
Right. So let's get into that. You are one of the founders of Common House Foundation. And what exactly is Common House?
So, we had a few, projects, or we have two projects, that we're starting to look at whether or not they should go to a foundation. And there's good reasons, lots of different reasons that projects evaluate whether or not they should go to an open source foundation. The most obvious anybody associated with Java would think of is Apache or Eclipse. And I was kind of looking at those, at the existing foundations, what they offer. I've been working on and with the Java language since 1990, something mumbled early.
Okay.
One of the earliest versions. I can't say it was the first version of Java, the very first, but it was in the point releases, right? Like Java forever,
mm-hmm.
basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so I use Jackson a lot as an example, right? Jackson is a project that everyone pretty much relies on. It's not in a foundation anywhere. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why mm-hmm. isn't it in a foundation anywhere? Like, what reasons, mm-hmm. right? Why do the existing foundations don't work? And if I talk to Tattoo, which I did, the reasoning for that is, like, he could list out all the reasons. And a lot of it has to do with conditions that foundations often impose on how projects are run.
Such as,
and I find, does everything go from a decision of the project leader to a decision by committee is the biggest one.
Okay.
And if you look at Apache, if you look at Eclipse, if you look at CNCF, they all say you have to have multiple vendors. You are instantly in decision by committee. There's good historical precedent for that. I think there's certain projects that definitely benefit from, okay, you really should have multiple vendors involved because we don't want you to be totally affiliated with one product forever and ever and whatever. Mm-hmm. And often there's also contention, right? And when you have contention between people, having a little bit more required procedure mm-hmm. around decision making can just, help that function. Mm-hmm. But I kind of am like, well, I don't necessarily know at this point that matters as much, right? Mm-hmm. We're in a place where we're looking for how to make open source more sustainable. Mm-hmm. How can we help projects raise money for themselves? Mm-hmm. Not necessarily like, do you support an individual maintainer or do you try to fund the infrastructure and stuff used by a project? Where a project isn't its own legal entity at that point. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's all things we need to, that a foundation can do mm-hmm. such that then an individual doesn't have to deal with it.
Right. Yeah.
And it just seems to me like we should be able to go into that space without as many constraints as we felt were necessary in the early 2000s when a lot of these foundations were born. Because we're post Patreon and Kickstarter, right? Like, we're in a different era. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more kind of established practice around how we collectively collaborate on software. Mm-hmm. I mean, GitHub, GitLab, those mm-hmm. have helped a ton.
Right.
Yeah. There's just kind of a lot more understood practice. It's interesting talking to people about it because you have people who have worked on these projects who are like, yes, please. Mm-hmm. I would like a home. I mm-hmm. just don't want to be hamstrung in my ability to make decisions because I joined a foundation.
Right.
Yeah. As an example. Right. Mm-hmm. And I also, when I try to explain this, it's like, I'm not trying to steal projects from any of the existing foundations because they're all awesome.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the projects who have already said never. Okay. Right. Like, they've already said none of these other foundations are interesting to me. So the question mm-hmm. is, okay, why? Mm-hmm. Can I provide a home for you?
Right.
How do we do that? Yeah. And that brings some interesting considerations because when I talk to people who are used to running foundations, it's like, well, why are these projects not in foundations? Some of the time it's interesting personalities that have mm-hmm. You're good to deal with the people who don't want to cooperate with others.
Right.
It's like, yep, that might bring things.
Yeah.
So, to some extent, I mean, if I'm honest, right, like mm-hmm. I'm taking on a risky population of projects. Mm-hmm. Like that's just it.
Yeah.
But I'm also trying to structure things in a way that involves all of these people more directly. So they're invested in the foundation's success.
Right.
You see what I mean?
Yes,
like,
of course.
Yeah. It's in their best interest to make things function well.
So, and I love that because I think your vision, it is collaborative. I mean, you want to be able to have these projects in one place, right? So they're in a way protected, but they're also open to having them live in this foundation so they can be successful. Right. So,
yes.
So what challenges have you encountered in launching Common House?
So we're still in the bootstrapping stage.
Okay.
Right. So we're still in a fairly early phase of getting everything started.
Okay.
And now we're getting to the place where we have bylaws for the most part. Okay. There's like two sections, I think, that aren't done yet.
Okay.
And it's once you get into where the actual legally required lines are, that things get interesting, because there's a feeling of, well, I don't want bureaucracy and I don't want constraint. It's like, yes, but
yeah, you also want to be covered.
Ownership of an asset changes hands.
Yeah,
then
right.
There's things we have to write down and establish, and that's not bureaucracy for its own sake.
Right.
That's defensible trademark ownership, for example.
Right.
Right. So it's not that you can't have a license that would allow you to do this, but we do have to write down that you have permission to do this.
Right. It's protecting them,
and so that's
as well
where
as you.
Things get interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, it's protecting.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. But when you have someone that's used to operating all by themselves,
yeah.
It feels gross.
Right. Yes. I get
which
it.
I understand. Right?
Right.
It's like, no, I get it. I understand that this feels gross. But if we don't do this, then it doesn't work.
Right. Yeah.
Long term.
So what are you excited about launching this?
I am excited about kind of pushing the envelope of what is allowed. Right. And so if I'm real realistic, right? Common house as a new thing is anytime you make a new thing, it's risky. You can either be super successful or it goes a couple years and then we have to fold.
Right.
So minimally, let's say bad things happen. I mean, nobody wants that to happen. I want this to be successful and I want us to be self-sustaining and I want, you know, future, not me, who's running the foundation at that point,
right,
to have a good system and to have community still participating. Like, ultimately, that's where I would. But, like, let's say it doesn't happen because we couldn't satisfy all requirements or costs or who knows why. If we get to the place where, I mean, 501c6s dissolve. And when you do that, the assets change to a different foundation. But, like, as an impact to the ecosystem perspective, what I hope is that minimally we challenge some of the assumptions about how a foundation has to work.
Get it.
Yeah. Right. So maybe we end up combining with another foundation, but in a way that is less restrictive, or we find a way to make a more permissive branch or a differently operating branch of that foundation or something. I don't know. I'm making it up. But you see what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
What I'm hopeful of is at the minimum, we push on the boundaries of, well, why do we do these things?
Right.
Right. Like I asked a friend of mine, why do we do all this incubator, graduated, like all that stuff? Because what I see is that that's a lot of work. Like, that's a lot of man hours to put that material together. Here's the incubation proposal. Here's the graduating proposal, which means everybody has to write it. And then you have to review it.
Right.
And then you have to vote on it.
Yeah.
And that's hours.
Yeah.
Hours and hours and hours of work. And I'm like, why? What good does that serve?
Right.
Other than getting somebody a sticker. Like, please tell me why that is important.
Right.
Given the man hours involved, or the person hours. Let's be better gendered, Aaron.
Yeah.
But it's so much work.
Right.
And I don't see the benefit. Oh, yeah, you get a marketing splash page. Oh, please. You could do a marketing splash page just because. Like, I don't.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I don't get it. I don't see the value for that work.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to challenge some of those assumptions. Do you have to have that to be a foundation? Really? Why?
So what has been the response when you've spoken to people about Common House?
That was a real fear that I had when I was going to, as we launched at DevNexus in April. And I would say that was my biggest concern. I'm like, I don't know. I don't know what is going to happen.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't. It was like I really didn't understand what was going to happen when that day came. And the response was really amazing.
Good. Well, that's awesome.
It took me by surprise. I do think people realize that I am not, like I said earlier, that this is not a zero-sum game. Right? I'm not trying to tank any other foundations. It's not competitive in that sense.
Right.
And I was really relieved when people understood that.
Because
I was worried, like, that somebody would think I was coming after their bacon. And it's like, no, I'm really not.
Yeah.
And so I felt pretty good about that. And then there were a lot of people who were like, no, we really need this.
Oh, that's amazing.
And it was so great. Right. Yeah. But again, it's like this, it will be in the next couple months as we roll the rest of this out. Mm-hmm. It is going to be finding the balance of pragmatism, mm-hmm. and I don't want a purity test over governance per se, but mm-hmm. I want transparency,
yeah.
right? So people can understand how a project is running. That has to be clear. Mm-hmm. Do I want to, over time, help encourage projects to improve their governance practices? Yes, mm-hmm. especially given secure supply chain and other things. Like, there's best practices we should all be improving on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To ensure a project stays healthy over time and to ensure that the next generation of people can come in.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's where, you know, finding the balance, because I know, like, immediately some people are like, well, now you're getting in my space. Well, no.
Yeah.
But, right, we should be thinking about how to make some things better over time, right? Without imposing a bunch of man hour requirements. Make work, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think in a way you're guiding them towards, you know, like in a different way, like other foundations would be doing their own way, right? So you have your own practice, and it's not like you're trying to monopolize anything. You want to be able to show them this is what, you know, this is what I can offer, and I think it would work for your project.
There's things where I would like to recommend some practices because they improve transparency. Mm-hmm. Like GitHub, I'm doing most things through GitHub at the moment. I'm supporting GitLab. That I mean, like projects could be hosted on GitLab or other platforms. I don't have a problem with that. It's just I can't do all of the things. Mm-hmm. So right now I'm focused on GitHub, but like both GitHub and GitLab have integrated support for code owners. And code owners make it really transparent if you have areas of code that are more sensitive than others.
Okay.
So if someone wants a pull request to this area of code, mm-hmm. one of these two people has to review it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But guess what? Everybody can see that when mm-hmm. you create the PR, those people get tagged.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it just improves transparency and it improves governance. And at this point, it's just a recommendation. I'm not requiring people to have one.
Right.
But that's a step towards better governance, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that even is governance. Like, it's an aspect of governance, but it's not like thou shalt have a committee and make your decisions on mailing lists. Like, that's a different kind of activity that I really don't want I don't want to tell people how they need to make decisions.
Mm-hmm. No.
There could be one guy that just says, I win.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, one person could just be like, this is my project and you can make all the proposals you want. And if I don't like it, I'm not going to do it. I mean, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
It might be great for the project for right now.
Right.
I kind of get to the place where over time, I think projects will be encouraged to be more flexible.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're going to want to have other committers, especially if the person starts to recognize, well, maybe I need to not be working on this all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's then, okay, so how, if you bring in another person, do you guys then,
right,
you people, y'all,
yeah.
make decisions together?
Right.
So
that adds another layer to it. Yeah. That adds.
I would like to be in a position where we can mentor them and where we have other projects that can help saying, well, here's how we do it. And here's how we do it.
Yeah,
because the foundation doesn't have a way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, that's the part I don't like, is I don't think the foundation has to define the way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I like that. That's really cool. Okay, so who would you credit for where you are now?
My dad.
That's awesome.
He thinks it's really weird. He doesn't understand.
Really?
But like at my age, it's like, gosh, would I have expected to say, oh man, my dad, but mm-hmm. seriously, I'm turning into my dad. Like, it's a little ridiculous. I'm like, whoa, my 70s are going to be wild.
I love it.
but, but he, the conversations that we had around my dinner table, around the dinner table when I was young, you know, 13, 14, 15, 16, those are formative years as you're growing into an adult when you start to try to understand how grown-up world works.
Yes.
And his, he has no respect for authority unless they earn it, which does not necessarily mean, I mean, he can be kind of hard to deal with sometimes, but basically meant that I have never had fear of authority. I'm not that person where if somebody says jump, I'm going to say how high. I'll say why. Is there any point in me jumping? I'm not going to jump just because you're telling me to jump.
Like, yeah.
And even, and if there's a problem there, I'm going to say, no, I'm not jumping because there's sharks in the water. Forget about it.
Yeah.
Right? It's like to take a totally ridiculous example, but my willingness and lack of fear in talking to whomever I felt I needed to talk to has been pretty shaping, I would say. Right? I've been able to do a lot of things because I just go talk to people and I don't worry about it. That's hard to say. It's not that I don't worry about it. I try to be thoughtful, right? Like you can't just go talk to someone and have zero respect for their time, for example, right? But do I say I can't go talk to this person because they're my boss's boss or my boss's boss's boss? No.
Okay.
Right? I don't follow hierarchy well.
But in a way, it's not so much as you not following hierarchy well. It's that you have... you have your own perspective, you know, and how you lay that out is because of how you've learned from your dad. But also, it's your way of dealing with what you have in your environment, right, and your work. So, but I think it's also like it's giving you like your own sense of what's what's good for me and what's good for my community. That's how I'm approaching it, right?
Always. Yes, that kind of thoughtfulness. If you're not thoughtful about it, about going and talking to whomever, that backfires almost every time. But I have actually had a situation where I had a manager and he and I did not, we were oil and vinegar. We just did not go together. Maybe if you shook us enough, we might make good salad dressing, but really the separation happened almost immediately afterwards. We just didn't function together. And he tried to give me a couple things where it's like, well, I need you to do this. And I was like, no. And he, like, I'm not doing it. And like the look on his face was like, I asked you to do it. What do you mean you're not doing it? I'm like, it's a pointless waste of my time. I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it just because you told me to do it. Like, I just know. And you could just see him be like, but I'm your boss. And I'd be like, I don't care. Fire me. Which is just, like, I don't have that fear, I guess. And I also, over the years, noticed that I don't have a permission-seeking thing. You know what I mean? There, I remember I was talking to one of my colleagues and in early days, right, when we were kind of, it's like that first promotion after you get hired. And they're like, yeah, well, no one's made me a team lead yet. I'm like, wait a minute, you need to be blessed to be a, wait, what? It was like they were waiting for permission to show leadership, or like they were waiting for the leadership fairy to kind of bless them before they could be recognized as a leader. And I just didn't, like, what? Like, what do you mean? Why? What? Like, no, you show leadership in all kinds of ways before the, you know, like the blessing comes later. But I didn't understand, like, it was just a foreign way of thinking for me that I have since realized is pretty normal. It's just not one that I have. And that's my dad, 100%.
That's great. So, what are your goals for Common House moving forward?
So, near-term goals, right? Our bootstrapping period ends in April.
Oh, cool.
So, the requirement for us to exit our bootstrapping phase is we have finalized all of our bylaws, all of our policies, because, again, the projects that we have in the bootstrapping phase, they have a say in how the policies are shaped. Mm-hmm. That's important to me, right? Mm-hmm. I want the policies of the foundation to work for the projects in the foundation. And right. So those projects that have joined during the bootstrapping phase have the ability to influence how those policies are implemented, mm-hmm. or, you know, even what they say. So that's right. all good. I also have to finish the fiscal hosting agreement and asset transfer agreements, so that when projects are ready, they can sign on the dotted line and say, yes, we are transferring all of our assets to you. Common House now owns these things. And that's then 5 projects need to be left to exit the bootstrapping phase correctly or mm-hmm. properly. Okay. I have no illusions, I guess, being a practical person. I could see that we could lose a few. We got 9. We started with 5. Mm-hmm. We are at 9. No, we're at 10 now.
Wow.
But I could see when we get through all of the agreements and people understand what these policies are, I could see a few people saying this actually won't work for me. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. I'm okay with that. As long as we end up at the end of that period with 5, we're still good.
That's great. Yeah.
And there's things that I want to do, like a concerted individual membership drive. Membership for this foundation is individual humans and not companies, mm. which is a little different. Mm-hmm. But one of the things, again, for some of these projects that were like, no, for some of these other foundations are, it's too vendor oriented. Mm. We don't like that it's vendors making the decisions.
Right. Yeah.
And it's a difficult balance sometimes because infrastructure costs and all those things, like vendors are that's the deepest pocket, mm-hmm. right? So mm-hmm. how do you find the balance for that, right? So I'm trying to get to a place where I have a lot of individual people mm-hmm. supporting the foundation and or individual projects mm-hmm. and rather than, you know, then you have, I still want vendors involved and companies involved, and I want to take their advice, especially, mm-hmm. and we'll have an advisory board,
right?
So that they can give larger money. So like, cause again, foundations need money, right?
Yes. Yes.
So getting to a self-sustaining cash flow, I mm-hmm. guess, would be the other thing that I need to be doing. Right. Yeah. And it is like, reading all things about foundations, it's like, well, get ready to ask for money all the time.
Yeah.
And it feels so gross. Like, I don't want to ask for money.
But... Right. But it's for a cause. It's not for anything yes. else other than like to create this thing to keep it sustained. Right. So, correct. I mean, yeah. And
so the best thing I can do there is to make sure that I'm staying true to what my projects need mm-hmm. and the spirit that developers like, such yeah. that I do have enough individual contributors, mm-hmm. Individual sponsors, right, that we can keep the lights on yeah. and be a little more vendor independent.
Right.
And that's really the challenge is, can you get, or even then, like, or have a large, like the other thing that I would love to get to is to have vendor sponsorship, but from atypical sources. Mm. So if you think about, I'm going to challenge you for a minute. If I was going to start up a foundation, what companies would I go for?
Oh.
Usually. Oracle, IBM, Red Hat, Microsoft. Oh.
Wow, Amazon.
Amazon.
Yeah, right? Amazon. Yeah.
It's like you could list them on your on two hands, right? Like who yeah. the most popular sponsors you would go for are. Mm-hmm. I would love to see more consumers.
Really?
Banks, huh. hospitals.
Wow.
Insurance companies.
Right.
You know, the people who want these projects to live who aren't necessarily the employers,
right,
the typical tech employers.
Got it.
And then especially trying to get smaller companies so that they can, you know, so it can fit within their budget and they can chip in mm-hmm. and feel good about it, right? And feel right. like they have just as much clout as a big company.
Yeah. Yeah. Since they have
we also just do what we can do, you know?
Right, because they have a stake in it now as well, which is great, you know? Huh, okay. So if anyone wanted to know more about you and Common House, how would they go about it?
So I'm on LinkedIn, if you look at Aaron Schnabel. I do have a blog, which is ebullient.dev. Ebullient is my favorite adjective ever. All definitions of that word apply to me. I will leave it as an exercise to the listener to go look that word up because it's good.
Yep, it's a good word. I love it. Yep.
Every time I see it in print, which is fairly infrequent, I do a little happy dance in my chair, which is, again, part of the course. Common House is www.commonhouse.org, and house in that case is the old school German, you know, H-A-U-S, is Common House, which is a throwback to Code House, which was Jackson, and you know, we had a bunch of projects in the Java ecosystem that started as Code House projects.
Got it.
And so this is trying to create a software foundation that brings forward the spirit of what Code House was at the time. And I had, like, Tattoo was a Code House member, right? Huh. And part of what they explained with Code House was, Code House was more than just like a code repository. They had IRC channels. They had more of a community. It was very much like a joint kind of collective effort.
Mm.
And that's exactly what I'm trying to go for here also.
I like that. Yeah. It's really all about community. That's great. I love that.
And no specs, no specifications.
Okay.
I am not doing specifications. We're just going to work together to build cool, fun things. And if other people want the long-winded discussions about specifying things, they may do that elsewhere.
Okay. So is there anything you'd like to say to my listeners?
My dare is kind of to think about, especially where we are, I think, societally or even globally right now, with what role women have or should have or can have, and really chew on how many labels you think are actually harmful or don't actually apply or are unrealistic, or because I think a lot of them, I have a, my daughter and my niece are both struggling with the gender identity concept right now. And I think we're talking about that, like, it's been my opinion that we're actually having that conversation completely the wrong way. Because I think in their case, watching the, you know, the way questions are being asked, or the wardrobe choices that are being made, or the haircut choices that are being made, and then the flack that they get because they look like a boy. And it's like, we had tomboy stuff when I was little. But it was always kind of expected that it was a phase that you would go through. And I kind of feel like there is an expectation of what it means to be a woman, how you dress, how you look, your hair, your makeup or not, your earrings, your nail, you know, like there's this whole, you know, thou shalt shave your legs, like all this dumb stuff. Right. And I think a lot of the gender questions we're having right now is basically because those boxes are stupid. The expectations are stupid.
Right. Yeah.
And so if like, if someone opts into being a young woman, I'm going to be real candid here and just say the thing for everybody to chew on. What sexual expectations are there? Like, if I look at what my kids see in media, there's a big dichotomy there. There are young women being told they can do and be anything.
Right.
They can be engineers. You also have hypersexualized media. Right?
Like,
why do I want to opt in to being judged to those appearance standards?
Yeah.
Why is that part of how I have to grow up, right? And so when I'm looking at young people really struggling with that, I'm like, I think the boxes are dumb. And so I think our whole, all this pronoun conversation and everything else is, it's like, if I use this pronoun, here's all the baggage that comes with it, and I am not interested.
Yeah.
And I just don't think we're thinking about it that way.
Right. Yeah.
And so that would be for all of your listeners, like, chew on it. Are you helping impose those constraints on other people? Is that something you do by assumption? Like, I know my dad's siblings, they want to just be able to decide, is that a girl or a boy? They don't want the stuff in the middle because for them, classification is important.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where friction comes from. It's like, well, of course you're either one or the other.
Right.
Like, well, unless you think that box is really not you, then what do you do?
Right. Yes. Yeah, that makes sense.
So anyway, that's a controversial topic. But like for me, looking at future generations coming up too, it's like, we've got to have this conversation more constructively. Because I just think right now we're not having that conversation, honestly. With each other.
Right.
Tangled it all with a whole bunch of stupid labels and everything else. And it's like, but you're not listening to but this is Aaron's opinion. Of what is,
no, but I mean, that makes sense. And it is something to chew on because we have been, the labels and all of these boxes have been ingrained in us.
Yeah.
And trying to get out of it, to trying to not have to fit in a box has been, like, at least for me, like, okay, well, which box do I fit in? it's like, and do I want to fit in a box? I don't know if I want to, I mean, this is, again, these are just like my opinions, like you have your opinions. And it is like for young people, it's like, I mean, it's a lot to think about. Figure it out. So,
if you look at the cultural pendulum, especially in the States right now, you can see the discomfort with people not fitting in the right boxes or how far people want to take the choice to go for the other box. Like, people are making, I think, reactionary, subpar decisions sometimes. We're not having an honest, in my mind, we're not having the honest conversation about the expectation and the, that typing, that stereotypical expectation thing.
Yeah.
Really being part of the problem.
Yeah.
It's like subtext kind of, but I feel like if we had a better way to address it up front, it would be a different
situation. Oh, I think so. Yeah. Situation. I think so too. Okay. So if you had one
thing. Anyway, that's my new mantra. The boxes are dumb.
Okay, I like that. If you had one thing to change that you wish had done years ago, would there be one thing?
I just think that's a dangerous question.
Hmm.
Because I don't know.
Okay.
Like, are there regrets? Like, I wish I wouldn't have had, that particular reaction in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if I hadn't had that reaction in that situation, would I have learned that lesson?
Right, yeah.
Don't know. Right? I don't think I can go back and get a redo because then I wouldn't be who I am now.
Right.
That's such a cop-out answer, but really, I am who I am because of where I went.
Yes, I get it. Yeah. when you're talking about that, it's like, everyone has things they wish they had done better years ago, or maybe not, And that's okay, too.
It's not that, I don't do the no regrets thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do the no regrets thing. I absolutely have regrets. I wish I would have handled that situation better.
Mm-hmm.
But that does not mean I would go back and redo it. Right. Because I learned from that situation.
Yes.
Right? Learning how to not ruminate on it is a challenge. Right? Okay. I should not obsessively ruminate on this thing I wish I would have done better. That's a skill that you have to learn to interrupt, right? But the bad experiences you learn from. So if I went and did it different, I wouldn't be where I am now.
Right. No, you're right. Okay. And my last question is, if you could go back in time, what advice would you give your younger self?
I've had many people who have given me good advice over the years that sometimes I wish I would have been able to anticipate earlier or apply earlier. Like, being more patient. Mm-hmm. I'm still not patient. I still jump in on conversations almost all the time and make people crazy. I'm mildly better than I was at 26, but okay. Still not great. Right. I got good advice like a long time ago that I still struggle with, but it was the right advice. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, taking that little bit of time to try to organize your thoughts so mm-hmm. that you're not trying to explain something to someone starting in the middle of the story.
Okay. Yeah.
But that's, you know, I still struggle with that one, but it's the, you know, it is telling my younger self, like, breathe, listen, try to be organized, and you can still do this.
I love it. Erin, thank you so much for coming on the show and for sharing your life and your work with me and my listeners. And I wish you so much luck with Common House. And it'll be really interesting to see what happens in the next couple of months. I would love to keep in contact, and, you know, you can keep me posted. But, you know, it's like when I first approached you about this, and I'm like, honestly, I am not a tech person, but my goal for having you on, or one of my goals, was to really just to get to know what makes Erin want to do this. You know, why, what's her purpose? And I love what you're doing, because it really is like you're creating something that will be not just for, you know, the foundation is geared towards people and not, mm-hmm. you know, and not towards vendors or organizations or, and at the bottom of that is like really the community, which I love. So I wish you so much luck with that. I think it's going to be amazing.
Well, thank you.
So I can't wait to like hear more about it, you know, in the next couple of months. No, and I love it. And you know, and I love that you shared your beginnings with me, because it really shows, you know, that's what I love about speaking with my guests, because it shows me like where they started and where they're going, you know, and like the in-between is awesome. But I think what's great is that what you've done previously has pretty much shaped like where you're going to be moving forward. So
yes,
I love that. So, well, with that, thank you. Have a great rest of the day, and I will catch up with you soon.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you for coming on. I'll talk to you soon. Okay. Bye. That's our show for today. I've posted more information about Erin Schnabel on RevWoman.com. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll tune in every other Thursday for another episode of Revolutionary Woman. You can listen to Revolutionary Woman on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Just a little note. I've launched a Patreon account to support the show. All proceeds will go to producing and editing the episodes to give my poor husband a break for being my personal IT and production department. He wrote this. The address is patreon.com/revwoman.